It's not about stigma, guilt, or being a moral failure. Recovery is about life. If you have a spouse, child, or friend who is suffering from addiction, there is hope. Stepworks has helped thousands in Kentucky recover their lives, marriages, and families from addiction. Come rediscover life at Stepworks. For more information, contact us at 800-545-9031 or visit our website, stepworks.com.
Welcome, everyone, to the Stepworks Connect podcast. I'm your host, Eric Gonzalez. The purpose of this podcast is to inform and educate you, the listener, about addiction, addiction treatment, and recovery. We felt it was important to talk about these topics, and to help us with that, we will have guests and speakers on that have worked in or have dealt with addiction. And the guest on this inaugural episode is Dr. Tom Ingram, the founder and CEO of Stepworks Recovery Centers. Now, in full disclosure, I do work for Stepworks, but I felt that he would be a great guest in helping us to set the stage for what we're wanting to talk about and where we can go from here. So, without further ado, thank you, Dr. Ingram, for joining us. For the listeners, can you give us a little bit of your background, some of your credentials?
Sure. It's a pleasure to be with you. So, I attended medical school at the University of Kentucky. And having graduated from there, I needed to find a residency, and I decided to go into family medicine. And I moved to Charleston, South Carolina, not because it was anything special in terms of academics, but because it was on the ocean and they had a beach. but as it turns out, that was quite a fortuitous choice. The family medicine program at Charleston at the time was unique from a lot of the other family medicine programs. It had an embedded behavioral health component with it. So we had psychologists and therapists and chemical dependency counselors in our program, and we were taught about things. And we also did something called BALANT training. And that goes back to a guy that was born at the turn of the century, Dr. BALANT. And Dr. BALANT believed that the most important thing in any sort of medical encounter was the patient-physician relationship. In particular, he believed that the physician needed to be able to actively listen to what the patient was saying and to understand that not only what the patient was presenting to you was accurate on the surface, but that what he was presenting actually reflected a much more deeper context in regards to their life. And so we had weekly sessions where we sat down as doctors and shared patients and discussed how the interaction with that patient made us feel and what did that mean. Because sometimes patients can transfer emotions onto you. And it also was a time where we sat down and talked about the language that patients used and trying to figure out what did that really mean. And in retrospect, that sort of started me down a path in healthcare that was beneficial in family medicine, but eventually beneficial in addiction medicine as well. The techniques that we learned in BALANT training and the exercises that we did for 3 years during residency is the closest that you would come in medicine to learning how to be a profiler, learning how to quickly assess a patient and where they're coming from, what are they saying both on the surface and underneath the surface, what's the context in which they bring to the exam room or to the interview room. So I spent 3 years in Charleston completing a family medicine program. And left there having absolutely no desire any plans to do anything in the behavioral healthcare field. I was going to leave and be a family doctor like you used to see on TV. Now, this was 25 years ago now, and medicine was quite a bit different then, but that was my plan. So I moved to Elizabethtown, Kentucky out of residency to be your family doctor.
And how long were you a family practitioner?
Well, once a family practitioner, always a family practitioner. I joined a couple of doctors when I moved to Elizabethtown, and we built a practice from a few independent physicians up to about 12 physicians at one point. That was right at the cusp of where family medicine, primary care, the term primary care entered the English language. And we built a practice that thrived and still thrives today. We've iterated it a couple of times, but I still operate Heartland Primary Care in Elizabethtown, Kentucky, and we offer primary care to about 16,000 patients.
Wow. That's fantastic. You've been a family practitioner your entire professional career, but what made you decide to get into behavioral health and addiction medicine?
Well, when you first graduate out of school, you're starving, you have a whole bunch of debt, and so you need to generate some money. And oftentimes you do that by moonlighting, working outside your day job, and I did that in emergency rooms. But when I moved to Elizabethtown, I had the opportunity to do some work at Lincoln Trail Behavioral Health System, which is a freestanding psychiatric hospital located right outside of town. At the time, they were hiring my partner, and they offered me the position to come alongside their chemical dependency patients that they had in the hospital and help follow them. We were paid just a per head fee, and all we had to do was see them a couple of times a week, and it was really quite a good opportunity for a doctor fresh out of school. As time went by, though, what I learned about myself is that all of that time spent in ballot training, that time that I didn't necessarily enjoy when I went through it, and that time that I didn't really intend to use when I got out, I found that that was actually a very valuable skill set. And as I sat down with these patients who were suffering primarily from alcoholism at the time, I learned that being able to sit with them and listen to their stories and to understand them as individuals allowed me to reflect back to them some facts and some observations that they needed to hear in order to understand their disease of addiction. And so in essence, what I found was that my training and who I had become as a physician lent itself very well to being a valuable resource for people in addiction. I was at Lincoln Trail for a number of years and eventually served as their chemical dependency director before leaving to form StepWorks.
Wow. It's a long journey to get right to StepWorks. Since we're kind of going along this story, what made you decide to start StepWorks?
So this was way back in 2002 or so. I was working at Lincoln Trail. At any given time, I had between 12 and 20 patients that I was taking care of. Unfortunately, in an institutional environment and in a hospital environment where you have patients who come and they go, the practice of medicine becomes very cookbookish and in chemical dependency treatment in particular, it has a tendency to become very routine so that every patient is treated like every other patient. And there soon gets to be a feeling like the patients aren't individuals, they're just objects moving through the doors. And everybody gets this treated the same regardless. And that was frustrating for me. And so I tried to change that, but Lincoln Trail was like any other big hospital, any other big system. Making changes is hard. Making changes is very hard when you have to pull teams of people together. And in particular, when you're trying to change the way people think about addiction and think about addiction care, it became impossible to do in that environment. And so I started thinking, well, maybe I could do it better myself. So the concept of StepWorks was born about that time. In 2003, we launched the company. We thought we were going to be an outpatient treatment provider, but as it turns out at the time, you couldn't find anybody wanting to do outpatient. They all wanted to do 30-day residential care. And so we transitioned quickly into that business model. We secured space in the Helm Mansion in Elizabethtown. The Helm Mansion was built in the mid to late 1800s and was built by one of the previous governors of the state, a 10,000 square foot antebellum mansion, actually sitting across the street from Harvard Memorial Hospital. And we started there with absolutely no idea of what we were doing. There were no other residential treatment centers in the state, and there were no books you could buy that says, this is how you form a residential treatment center. I had the privilege of having some key people from Lincoln Trail follow me to StepWorks and help develop what we were doing. We opened up.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but so you basically had to create everything from the ground up. You had no real resources or guides to start the treatment for clients at the facility.
Right. This was all how do you provide the best care to a group of people who could die if you don't? How do you do that in a cost-effective way and in a humane way? In a caring way to a group of patients who weren't used to being treated with dignity. Mm-hmm. At the time that we opened up, there weren't a lot of resources that you could call upon to tell you what to do, much less how to do it. And so I, plus a couple of other smart people, had to figure it out on our own. Mm-hmm. And that's what we did.
Now, was there any kind of pushback or in the community at all, or was it just too new that people were just like, okay, let's see what happens?
Well, at the time in early 2000, addiction wasn't anything like it is today. We were talking mm-hmm. mostly about alcoholics, and we were talking about a few people that were addicted to prescription medicines, but it wasn't the epidemic that it is today. Now, there's always been a stigma for addiction, and that goes back thousands of years. But at the time, we were a little bit freer to open up a facility, so we didn't get a lot of pushback from the community. Mm-hmm. At the time, insurance companies did not cover addiction care. At the time, Medicaid did not cover addiction care. And so our main group of patients that we launched with were patients who were self-pay. They were having to pay out of the pocket. And at that time, mm-hmm. Again, there were no residential treatment centers in the state. So at that time, your option, if you had a problem with chemical dependency, was to go to a place like Betty Ford, which is a big hospital and cost you about $30,000 a month to go for a 30-day stay. And that was about it. We opened up, again, making it up as we went, but we opened up, and our niche payment or the amount that we could deliver services for ended up being about $6,000 a month. So we were, 20%. That's not even the right math.
but considerably lower than...
We were... At the time, 1/6 the cost of Betty Ford and the other options wow. that were available. And wow. so we launched, and it took us a while to figure things out. And we had periods of time mm-hmm. where we had one patient in a facility that was supposed to have 16. And one patient isn't enough to pay the bills. And I had staff members who went without paychecks for a couple of weeks until we filled the house. And three of those staff members still work for me today, some 14 years later.
Wow. So how difficult was it to have clients come to the facility, seeming that it was a little bit harder, you know, at the time Medicaid or other insurance companies weren't carrying it. It was self-pay. How difficult was that?
Well, it was difficult to build up an internet presence. And so at the time, getting people to know who you were and where you were was a challenge. But that was also in the days that Google was becoming a big thing, and Google advertising was becoming a big thing. And so we had actually my son-in-law, who took the job of understanding Google advertising. This was before there was a lot of books that you could buy on Amazon to tell you how to do it. And so again, from a business standpoint, StepWorks is very much a bootstrapped company. We figured it out all ourselves. And that ended up being the key to our financial survivability, was the ability to help people find us. So really during those early days, the struggle of StepWorks wasn't so much how to take care of addicted patients. The struggle was how to keep your doors open while you figured out how to take care of addicted patients.
Right.
But looking back, that was the good old days.
That was the first facility, and you're no longer at that location and have moved, and also have one in London, Kentucky. What do you feel has changed coming from that first initial facility to the two current ones that are available?
So a lot has changed, and I guess to backfill the story a little bit, we operated StepWorks for a little over 10 years, and addiction started to become a niche industry in healthcare. There was a company out of New Jersey that was starting to come through and buy up some facilities. By 2012, there were at least two other residential treatment centers in the state, maybe three. The biggest one being modeled after us. To be honest, they came and presented an offer that we just couldn't refuse to purchase StepWorks. They gave us an opportunity to cash out of the residential treatment center business. And at the time, we were going to take that money and use it to build actually the addiction treatment 2.0, which was going to be an internet-based treatment center or an internet-based treatment effort called Recovering Me, which can be the subject of another talk. But we sold. And we sold with a lot of promises that the company that bought us was going to continue our good reputation, and that the company that bought us was all about delivering good care and treating people humanely and with dignity. Unfortunately, it wasn't long after we sold that it became clear that this company really did not share the same values that we did, and the quality of care started to decline. And it became an embarrassment to me, knowing that I had sold my company to someone who wasn't going to continue our good work. Luckily, they allowed us to keep our name, and they operate under a different name. And after a couple of years passed, the government under President Obama launched the Obamacare that everybody's familiar with. And what Obamacare did was provided a way for people to have Medicaid pay for their addiction treatment, because a lot of people with addiction, especially as we were entering into the 2014-2015 time period, addiction had switched from alcohol being the drug of choice to opiates, and then to methamphetamine, and then to heroin, and now we have the epidemic of addiction. But at the time, having Medicaid be able to pay for care was a sentinel event in addiction care in Kentucky, and suddenly people could get care. And suddenly, instead of struggling to keep your doors open, suddenly there were 60, 80, 100 people needing treatment for every bed available in the state. And so we relaunched StepWorks in 2015, having not done it for a couple of years. And we opened up our facility in London. Then we opened up a new facility in 2016 in Elizabethtown. And we've got two more in the pipeline to open up. But your original question was, how has it changed? And it has changed in so many ways. The patients that we're talking about are a lot sicker than the patients that we took care of before. They almost as a rule are IV drug users with hepatitis B and hepatitis C. Some have HIV. They are using substances that not only ruin their lives, but frequently will kill them in overdosing. So the importance of addiction treatment has increased many, many times, just because the acuity level of those with addiction increased dramatically. So from now to looking back, the complexity of the patients has increased a lot, but also the resources available have increased. The American Society of Addiction Medicine was formulated just a few years before we opened up StepWorks, so back in the 2000 range. Since then, we've had some medications be approved for the treatment of opiate addiction, such as Suboxone and Vivitrol. And so the scientific approach to the treatment of addiction has taken or made leaps and bounds in terms of our knowledge of how to do this right. What we learned early on with StepWorks had to do with, how do you treat people right? How do you treat them with dignity? How do you motivate them for change? How do you give them hope? How do they get past grief and shame? And those are still key parts of any treatment facility. But in the last 10 years, we also are operating with a brand new skill set in terms of understanding addiction as a brain disease, understanding how medications can help that or how medications can make that worse. And then I guess lastly, the major change has been funding. Now that patients can have their insurance pay for their care, then that makes it a whole lot easier to deliver care.
Right, right. So I want to go back a little bit. You hit on the topic of addiction as a brain disease. And recently I've seen that it's still controversial, where a lot of people make the argument that it's a decision, it's a constant decision on the addict's part to do this, and that they think that saying that it's in a brain disease is an excuse. How do you deal with that with clients, with families, or other people who try to make that argument?
Well, I guess first off, I would say that while the public may debate whether addiction is a brain disease, and while some psychologist and some therapist may debate whether addiction is actually a disease, the fact of the matter is that science has demonstrated to really an incontrovertible level that people who suffer from addictions do have a dysfunction in their brain that we can see on CAT scan, we can see on MRI. And to say that it's not a disease is just not being intellectually honest. Now, the reality, though, is that addiction is a very complicated disease. And so, yes, there are problems going on in your brain with neurotransmitters, but there are also problems that develop in thought processes, and problems that develop in relationships, and problems that develop in jobs, and problems that develop in your ability to control impulses that when people see that from the outside, they say, well, he's just a jerk, or he just doesn't understand. And if he just understood what he was doing to his family, what he was doing to me, then he would just stop. And that's really the framework for the treatment of addiction for the last couple hundred years, but certainly back to the famous Dr. Bill, who started AA, and the idea that to get a hold of your addiction, you needed to get in touch with yourself, and you needed a group of people to support you as you learned the reasons why you do the things you do. And that was the only approach 400 years. But what we've learned in the interim is that while those approaches work, AA works, 12-step groups work, they don't work for everybody, but they work for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. While they work, there's something going on underneath the surface that you can't see, and it's hard to understand. People will say, well, he drinks because he just doesn't know how to stop. Well, the reality is that the part of his brain, the part of our brain that allows us to know when we should do something or when we shouldn't do something, that part of the brain is diseased. It's injured. It's not functioning well in somebody with an addiction. And so the things that we stigmatize people for in terms of their ability to use or not use, their ability to stay clean and sober or not, that's really the essence of the injury that they have in the brain, is that part that controls impulse, that part that controls cravings. So despite people thinking that it's just a matter of will and a matter of choice for addiction, science has really proven that it's much more deeper and much more complex than that. CAT scans have shown it, MRIs have shown it. There's actually an interesting story about a guy that lived in the 1800s. His name was Phineas Gage, and Phineas worked on the railroad, building railroads, and he was involved in demolition. And so his job was, when they came across big rocks that they needed to get out of the way, they would drill holes into the rock, they would insert dynamite into that hole, and then he would come behind with an iron bar, and he would push the dynamite down to the very lowest part of the hole before it exploded. Well, one day, Phineas was doing his job, and for some reason, he tamped that iron bar down, and the dynamite exploded, and it sent this bar upwards, and it entered his cheek, his left cheek, and went out the top of his head.
Jesus.
And it landed about 100 yards away. And he was awake the whole time, sort of fell down and said, well, that's interesting. And so they hauled him to the hotel. And there's a great recount from his doctor, who said that he came to the hotel and Phineas was sitting in a rocking chair and was conversing normally, even though he had a big section of his skull that was no longer there, where this big iron bar had flown through it. Well, the interesting thing with Phineas is that he survived that and went on to live for a number of years, but he wasn't the same guy as he was before the injury. As you would expect, if you have a big iron bar going through your brain, you're not going to be the same guy. Well, physically he was. He originally was a very strong, bulking guy. He was actually described as somebody who was very, very smart, and someone who had a lot of plans, and he was going to make something of himself. Well, after this injury, what happened was they found that he went from being this very thoughtful guy who was a leader of leaders to someone who couldn't get along with anybody. And he started cussing a lot when before he didn't cuss at all. He started having troubles with what we call impulse control. So he would want to do one thing, but suddenly he would start doing another thing. And he would just sort of wander doing things that just struck his mind at the time. And then he had trouble with what we call executive function. So he had trouble with thinking and processing and understanding the consequences of his actions. So physically he was normal, but mentally he wasn't. And when you look at the transformation that Phineas went through after his injury, it's very, very similar to someone with an addiction. They have troubles with impulse control. They have troubles with executive function. They have troubles with their thought processes. Well, as it turns out now, we didn't know this back in the 1800s or even the 1900s, but now when we do MRIs on people with addiction, the parts of the brain that light up, the parts of the brain that are damaged when you're using cocaine or alcohol or opiates, are the same parts of the brain that Phineas had damaged with this iron rod going up through the middle of his brain. It's an interesting story, but there's lots and lots of other information. There's lots and lots of other supporting evidence that addiction is a brain disease. The challenge, though, and the hard part people have a hard time wrapping their head around is, what does that mean? Well, for us as physicians, what that means is that if we can track down the areas of your brain that are damaged and we can understand exactly what's happening, and in this case with addiction, what's happening is there are chemical messengers in our brain that send messages to tell us to do things and how to do things and when to do things. Well, if those messengers are disrupted or depleted, then we can develop approaches, medicines, that can help the body recover from addiction. And so by understanding that, we're starting to develop substances like Suboxone, which sort of fools the brain into thinking that it's got an opiate on board. And so some of those impulse control areas and some of those areas of the brain that control cravings that are just wildly out of balance in addiction, we've got medicines now that we can give that help control that. Doesn't cure it, and that's the other part of addiction as a brain disease, is that addiction is a permanent disease. You may have periods of sobriety, but the disease in the brain, the damage in the brain that somebody is either born with or somebody creates through the use of substances, that damage is permanent. You can get better, you can recover, but the damage is still there. And so you're really always just a few steps away from falling back into your pattern of use. And that's an important concept for physicians to realize, because addiction ends up being very similar to diabetes. We have no trouble believing that diabetes is a disease. We have no trouble understanding why somebody needs to take insulin or why somebody needs to take a pill to control their diabetes. We don't run around yelling at them saying, well, if you just quit eating, your diabetes would go away. Insurance pays for their treatment. Insurance pays for their medicines. It turns out that the incidence of diabetes in the general population, the adult population, is about 8 to 9%. So 8 or 9% of every adult has diabetes. Well, guess what? Addiction is 9 to 12%. So addiction is even a greater disease than diabetes. But also in a doctor's office, when you have somebody with a diabetic and he comes into your office and he's horribly out of control and you give him the right medicines and then suddenly he's better, you don't say, well, okay, goodbye, we'll see you if you start eating again. There's no sense that their diabetes is cured. Their diabetes is just under control. Same thing goes on with addiction. Your addiction is not cured. You don't go to 30 days of treatment and then suddenly you're cured and you don't need attention. It's quite the opposite. You go to 30 days of treatment, your brain's starting to heal, but you need long-term care because addiction is a chronic relapsing illness. So the idea that addiction is a brain disease really carries so much more with it and to it that to ignore that concept is really doing a disservice to our patients. I would argue that if you have someone that you see on TV who is strongly trying to argue that addiction is not a brain disease, one of two things is happening. Either they had a previous trouble with alcohol or drugs, and they've got that under control, and so they didn't require medicine. So they say, you know, I didn't need medicine, so it's therefore not a disease. That's one situation. Or the other situation is they're selling a book, and that's really it. You'll see commercials on TV for a certain treatment center in California, and a certain guy says that it's not a disease. He should know. He was an addict. Well, I'm glad that he is supposedly doing well and not using, but that doesn't change the fact that addiction is a disease that kills many, many people.
Right. And you may not have an answer for this, but just in this our conversation, it seems like we've made quite a jump in just knowledge about addiction medicine in the past 15 to 20 years or so. Do you think that's due to the technology, such as like the MRI scans, or do you think there's other factors as well that's contributed to that?
Well, certainly technology has contributed a lot. I mean, without MRI in particular, there's something called functional MRI. Without that, we wouldn't be able to prove these things. But again, stigma is a big part of it too. Why spend research dollars on an illness that society largely believes is one of the patient's own choosing? Mm-hmm. But you know what, Eric? I've never ever met an addict who said when they were a kid, you know what, I think I want to be an addict when I grow up. It just doesn't work that way. So technology certainly has been a major factor. Having enough knowledge to have the specialty of addiction medicine develop and have funding for research has helped. Having time to show that there are other approaches to the treatment of addiction other than 12-step groups has also been very beneficial in advancing our knowledge of the disease.
And kind of piggybacking off that response, how does StepWorks incorporate that notion where, like, for instance, you mentioned 12 steps is helpful for a lot of people, but not necessarily going to be for every single person? How does that concept fit into the curriculum at StepWorks?
Sure. So our curriculum is probably not surprising to you, but our curriculum is something we developed. We developed ourselves over or based on all of the years of experience that we've had. And so we don't take the canned approach. We're not a 12-step treatment facility, although we teach people about 12 steps. So we teach them about AA and NA, and everybody does a first step, which is a process where they explore their own history and understand how their life has become unmanageable because of their disease. But we like to think of our treatment as offering a smorgasbord. It's sort of like going to a food bar somewhere where you've got the choice to try things that you haven't tried before. And you'll find that some things you like and some things you don't. You'll find that some approaches to addiction resonate with you and some don't. And so we offer 12-step. We also have mandatory spirituality groups that people attend. We talk about another approach, which is called rational emotive. It's sort of the anti-12-step model that says, I'm not powerless. I have power, and I just need to put my mind to it, and this is how you do it. Mm-hmm. We introduce people to that. But we spend a whole lot of time just talking about the consequences of people's disease and how do you rebuild trust? How do you rebuild your life after having screwed it up? On top of that, though, is the treatment by our physicians who are board certified in addiction medicine. And so where there are medicines that can help, we use those medicines. Probably more often, there are medicines that don't help. There are medicines that tickle the same part of the brain that addiction is rampant in. And so we know the medications to avoid, and we know how to deal with patients' desires to take more and more things, trying to get better quickly. Mm-hmm. And so the There's an art to addiction treatment, and there's a science to addiction treatment, and we try to apply both, any and all. We try to do whatever we can do in our power to help people get control of their lives and help them not be a victim to their disease, because the mortality rate for addiction is much higher than that for diabetes or heart disease. Addiction is a potentially fatal illness. And if you don't grasp that first fact, you're really just taking people's money and not doing any good for your patients or for society.
I wholeheartedly agree. And that's the purpose of this podcast is, you know, we've talked a lot about StepWorks, and that may seem self-serving in a way, but being that this is the first episode of this podcast, we've talked a lot about addiction and the different topics involved with it. And so going forward, that's definitely the kind of direction we want to go with the content. I did want to say thank you for joining us today and for taking the time to kind of introduce listeners to what addiction is, what it's about, what the treatment can look like. And before we draw this to a close, do you have any kind of closing thoughts?
The biggest barrier to getting treatment is not understanding that addiction is a disease. The biggest barrier is for patients to say, I've got a problem and I need help. Mm-hmm. And so if there's anybody listening out here who has the problem of addiction or has a family member, the first thing you need to do is say, I've got a problem and I need help. And we would love to be able to provide that at StepWorks. But there's many, many providers out there. There's many people out there. There's many AA meetings out there. You just got to say, I need help. Because if you don't, this disease will sneak up and kill you, just like a bear would in the woods. And you need to take it seriously. And there's no time to say, I need help, like today.
Well said, sir. Well said. Thank you so much, Dr. Ingram. And definitely in the future, I'd like to have you back on and go more in depth about some of the topics you've introduced us to.
Sure. Anytime.
And there you have it, folks. And that brings our inaugural episode to a close. Thanks again to Dr. Ingram for joining us, and I hope that this was a good introduction for you all, and just a small taste of what we're looking to do with future episodes. So if you have any comments or suggestions, whether it be for content or even for guests, or if you would like to be a guest, please email us at podcast@stepworks.com.